This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the 12th Ordinary Meeting of the UC Law Society, which is in conjunction with the Islamic Society this evening, the public business of which is to discuss the motion that this House believes that Islam treats women right. This debate will be slightly different to our usual format of debates in that there will be only one speaker on each side. So rather than having speaking for 7 minutes each, they'll speak for approximately 12 to 15 minutes each, and then there'll be a period of rebuttal between the two, and then we'll open up the debate to the floor. So if any of you disagree with or maybe agree with something that one of the speakers said, then would be the perfect time to do it, and following that they'll have closing remarks. But during the initial speeches, when both speakers speak, I'll give them 1 minute of protected time. After 1 minute you'll hear this. That means that the floor is then open, so that's another time if you want to raise an issue with one of the speakers. I'd highly encourage any of you to do so. Obviously, opposing sides, you're more than welcome to do so as well. With regards to private business of the House, we have no motions on notice this evening. Has anybody got a motion for the Law Society that is not on notice? Very good. And there are no questions for the auditor at this time that are on notice. Has anybody got a question for me at all that has not been put on notice? Brilliant. Okay, because we're quite a bit late starting, we're going to skip through correspondence and get straight into the public business of the House. So without any further ado, it's my great pleasure to introduce to you this evening Mr. Abdullah Al-Andalusi, who is an international speaker and debater on Islamic affairs, and he's a co-founder of the Muslim Debate Initiative on Proposition this evening. Introduce Rebecca first and then you can take the podium. But okay. Speaking on the opposition this evening, we've got Rebecca McKinney-Perry, who is the Gender Equality Officer for the UCD Students' Union. Without any further ado, I'd like to call on Mr. Andalusi to open the case for the proposition and the debate as a whole. You're more than welcome to take to the podium, or if you prefer to stand there, it's completely up to you, whatever you're most comfortable with.
Thank you.
Hear, hear.
I greet you with the Islamic greetings of peace. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Peace and blessing of God be upon you all. I'd like to thank the UCD Law Society and the Islamic Society for inviting me. I kind of heard about this kind of last minute, and they said there's going to be a debate on the issue of women's rights in Islam. I thought, you know what? I'm up for the crack. So I will, this is what you say today, right? Yes, so I was interested to do this debate, especially because this issue, there's a lot of misconceptions about what Islam, its approach to women, its viewpoints towards women, and the Islamic creed towards women. So we're going to discuss some of these. First and foremost, getting straight into it, the Islamic viewpoint towards women and men is one of equality. So we see in the Quran, chapter 3, verse 195, God says, I do not waste the deed of any doer among you, be they male or female, the one of you is as the other. So we see, and that's just one of many verses in the Quran, which establish that there is a fundamental equality between men and women in the eyes of God. We see that the relationship between men and women is one of cooperation and not one of subjugation. So we see in the Quran, it says, and the believers, men and women, are friends one of the other. They enjoin what is right, they forbid what is wrong, and they establish worship and pay charity, and they obey God and his messenger, and for these God will have mercy on them. So the relationship between men and women in Islam is one of cooperation and allies, no battle of the sexes, or no subjugation. We also see that contrary to, unfortunately, some Islamophobes misrepresentation of Islam, Women are viewed as intellectually sound and equivalent to men. So we see that if a husband accuses his wife of impropriety, his testimony as one man can be negated by her counter-testimony, and that would be a negation. So there is an equal testimony between males and females. We also see that in the case of rape and in the case of a case concerning something to do with family, the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ accepted the testimony of one woman according to the hadith narrations. We also see that the women were foundational in the reporting of Islamic scripture. 40% of Sunni hadith literature, that's hadith is a recorded testimony saying or action or silence of the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ on something. 40% of it has been narrated by Aisha, his wife. That's 40% of the hadith corpus, or scriptural corpus, of the sunnah, as we say, or traditions of Islam, being related by a woman and being accepted, her testimony was being accepted, even though, or whatever her gender is irrelevant. Now, what people confuse about Islam is that they believe that in Islam, men are individualistic and women have to be devoted to family. This is not the case. Islam is not an individualistic ideology, and hence, I suppose, people from liberal backgrounds who believe in philosophic individualism sometimes misunderstand. Both the genders, male and female in Islam, they both revolve around the family, both of them. The family is considered to be the fundamental unit of society, not the individual. An individual doesn't create themselves, they don't educate themselves, they don't raise themselves. You are born into families. You're not born you're not born as an individual, independent of anyone, not needing anything, and raising yourself and culturing yourself by yourself. It doesn't exist. We're not islands unto ourselves. Now, I will discuss. Now, men have a lot of obligations to the family. They have to work and provide for the family. Whether they are poor and their wife is richer, men have a variety of obligations, and I'll go and only discuss women's rights on this issue. And in Islam, when we use the term rights, right is an obligation someone has to you. We don't believe that rights are just some kind of fundamental universal entitlement, as the natural rights, people who believe there's no such thing as natural rights in the universe in terms of it doesn't physically exist. What gives it existence? It is human duty. Humans acknowledging your rights and giving you your rights. So all rights start with duties. Now, in Islam, women have the right to own her own property. She can keep her property after marriage and not give any of it to her husband. She didn't have to change her name, so she didn't become her husband's property. In that sense, she needs to change her name. She retains her name. She has the right to full financial support for her needs. In marriage, irrespective, as I said, of whether she's rich or her husband is poor. She has the right to be given a marriage gift or a dowry. In many cultures, the woman has to give the husband a dowry. In Islam, we said no, the husband or the groom must give his prospective wife a marriage gift or dowry. In Islam, women have the right to vote. And what I mean by vote in this context is, in Islam we believe in something called the Pledge of Allegiance, or Bayah, where to establish anyone in authority, you must give a Pledge of Allegiance. And the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ was not content to only ask men for the Pledge of Allegiance, but also he asked women for the Pledge of Allegiance too, showing their equal parity in political engagement. Women and men both have the same obligation to seek knowledge. So in a hadith report by the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ, that seeking knowledge is an obligation upon every Muslim. Women have the right to work and own their own business. The Prophet's wife Khadija, she was a successful businesswoman. Women have the right to education to such degree that women at the time of Prophet Muhammad ﷺ complained that in mixed sessions of learning about Islam or learning education with men, they weren't able to concentrate properly because men always might cut in or want to ask their questions first or so on and so forth. So to rectify that, the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ had women's only days so that they can have direct access to the Prophet Muhammad, and he didn't give any men's only days, but he gave women's only days to ensure that they had the unfettered access they needed. Women have the right not to be physically or emotionally abused by her husband. This is related in the hadith by the Prophet Muhammad, who said, when a person came up to him and asked, what do you command us about our wives? Someone asked the Prophet, what do you command us to do to our wives, or how do we treat our wives? And he said, give them the same fitty, give them the same food that you have, the same kind of clothing you have, do not beat them, and do not insult them. So you can't even insult your wife verbally. We see that in Islam, the woman has a right to choose who she marries. A woman was forced by her father to marry someone against her will. She complained to the Prophet Muhammad offered to annul the marriage. Fortunately, she had grown attached to her husband. She goes, no, I don't want to divorce my husband. I'm just testing the principle. So Islam, women have the right to choose who she marries. She also has the right to emotional and sexual satisfaction from her husband. She also has the, which is also written in the narration by the Prophet Muhammad, whereby a man was staying away from his wife and he was engaged in spiritual actions, too many spiritual actions, and he was neglecting his wife. The Prophet Muhammad ordered him to go back to his wife, and he said, your wife has a right over you. And this includes that women have the right to her husband's, you could say, gametes, so to speak, his semen. A man can't say, I'm going to use contraception, and if the wife doesn't want that, the man can't use contraception. She has a right to it. She got married to him, and marriage is a consent to for reproduction. We see that in Islam, women have the right to dignity and respect. A mother in Islam is considered to be three times more respect worthy than the father. We also see that the woman has the right to take her husband to court if he's not fulfilling his obligations or duties under Islam, and to a Sharia court, maybe not in a Western court, they probably won't care, but in Islam, she can take him to court and he can be punished for not fulfilling his duties or for even abusing his wife. Now, I will recite some more interesting narrations that kind of underline this. So we see that the Quran tells men that to live with women on a footing of kindness and equality, which is the chapter 4, verse 19. We see that the relationship between a man and woman in a marriage is not one of subjugation and domination. The Quran says, and among his signs, he has created for you wives from amongst yourselves that you may find repose in them, and he put between you affection and mercy, not between you obedience and subjugation. We see that the Prophet Muhammad, the Quran tells men not to complain about their wives or to think, oh, why is my wife not having this or that? A man's meant to be content with even his wife's lack of something. So the Quran says, if you take a dislike to something in them, it may be you dislike a thing that God brings about this through a great deal of good. So if you might not like something in your wife, but you should accept her for who she is, maybe there is goodness in this. We see that the Prophet Muhammad even told men regarding sexual etiquette towards their women that men should not approach their women as an animal, but actually should engage in romantic gestures and so on and so forth to make sure that she feels that she's appreciated and not just lusted after as an object or sexual object. So we see, and then we see that the Prophet Muhammad said, the best of my community, the best of men, are those who are best to their wives. So the measure of a man is related to how good he is to his wife. But no one says that Islam is about the subjugation of men to the women. So it's about complementarity between the genders, and it's not about it's not about subjugation of one against the other. Both have rights against each other. And I would like to kind of juxtapose with perhaps some problems arising from Western philosophy on this matter. Generally speaking, in the West, it's considered now, along popular culture, maybe not you here, but along popular culture, that motherhood or being a housewife, although it's not obligatory for a woman to seek being a housewife or being a mother, but it is in Islam something which is praiseworthy, because being a mother, being the one who nurtures the future of mankind, is fundamental to the survival of the human race. The male, what is the male's role? You say, he gets to go to work and he has jobs and so on and so forth. But firstly, most of the guys here, or even the women here, you will not attain some noteworthy thing in your work that such that you'll be remembered for the next 100 years. Most of you won't be remembered after maybe 20 to 30 years after you die. Depressing thought, sorry. But you will work, you will pay your taxes, you will go on retirement, and then you'll die. Your grandchildren, ironically, your family will be the only ones that remember you, but the colleagues at your workplace will not generally remember you, and even those that have kept your name on record won't know what record is behind that name, or won't know who you are, they'll just know you as a name. Only a very small number of people in the history of humanity attain greatness, like Aristotle and Socrates and whatever, as we know their name. Most of us will live and die. In Islam, the man is, his relationship is an obligation to the family, is to work to provide for his family. And then once he's provided for his family and they're secure and they don't need him anymore, you know, like a drone bee, he dies and that's it, right? No one says, oh, how unfair Islam is upon men. No one says that. We've been coached to think that women should be judged by the standard of men, that unless they attain a career like men do, women have no value. They've turned women into economic objects now that can only be judged based on their value of how much money they produce or how much economic activity they do, which is incorrect. Of course, there's also the problem of the sexual objectification of women, which has become predominant unfortunately, in Western society. And feminists would agree with, some feminists would agree with me on this matter. You know, how fashion and the media leads women to feel socially compelled to mutilate themselves, to literally fit an inhuman definition of beauty thanks to Photoshop. We see with, actual physical mutilation, breast implants, injections of collagen, hair products, body waxing, high heels, which kind of chafes the back of your foot, so I heard. hair plucking, anorexia, bulimia, using hot irons, and even labiaplasties, which is basically female genital mutilation, which is permitted. We see in a lot of clinics that does plastic surgery, 90% of the clientele are women. Why is it 90% of the clientele for plastic surgery clinics are women? This is a great travesty. Why are women judged based on their looks and based on how they dress? This is a problem. Now, the thing is, when Islam insists upon modesty for men and women, by the way, what people don't know is that men have to cover their body shape and their navel to their knees. So any of you brothers wearing tight clothing, you should vacate the premises now and get changed. Islam believes in modesty for both, but because... So they're trying to put their hands down now. All right. The thing is that, okay... You might ask, well, why is it that Islam has women more covered up than men? Well, obviously, women have more evidence of reproductive anatomy on them than a man. That's just biology 101. Doesn't mean that women are more inferior than men, or men are more inferior than women, or so on and so forth. And all it's really saying is that, you know what, let's turn the public space not into a sexual zoo or into some kind of place where people are just constantly engaging in sexual politics and tensions and problems like this. Let's turn the public space into a professional space, an educational space, a space where you can socialize with people and you can interact with people, and sex is not the appropriate issue at hand in the public. So this is really what Islam's approach is to the whole issue of modesty amongst men and women. It's not designed to penalize women or men. It's not saying that if a woman is uncovered, that she deserves to be accosted physically. No, it's merely saying that, and even if a woman is even naked, she doesn't deserve to be raped, of course. We all agree on this. However, what it does say is that, you know what? We're all humans, right? And it's not a healthy environment when we're agitating each other sexually in public all the time. You know, if a man let's say, exposes himself indecently to a woman, obviously it'll be sexual harassment, he can go to jail. But we don't consider that the way some women dress in summertime can be also, by the same law almost, sexually harassing to men.
Point of information.
Okay.
Do you not think that if we reduce people to their base natures, that you're actually saying that you're an animal, and like men and women, and neither of you are actually capable of like logical thought? Like, not every man I see in shorts, I'm like, oh, those are a fine pair of knees. Like, because I'm logical, and you know, I don't objectify. So I think, like, if you're saying that if you're tempting people, I think that's reducing humans to almost base animals and base creatures, and implying that actually your base instinct is to accost sexually, which I don't think it is. I think that's actually kind of rude to both men and women to say that.
Okay, I didn't make that connection, actually. I only said it's sexual harassment. I didn't say it will make you rape that person. You must rape if you see. So I didn't say that. I said, it's sexual harassment. That's all I said. Because I don't have a switch in my head to say, I do not find this woman attractive. I will now become asexual, not heterosexual. I don't have that switch, right? No one says, I have decided intellectually to fancy this person. It doesn't work like that. We are creatures, but at the same time, Islam aims to prevent people from being reduced to base objects. That's the whole point. A woman and a man dressed modestly, you can't see their sexual base side of them. You see the human, an intellectual side of them, face, their expressions, and you only interact with them based on the content of their mind, not the content of their brassieres. So I would say that Islam actually aimed to elevate mankind above the very base viewpoint that sexual objectification happens. Sexual objectification is not known to happen historically in Islamic societies. It's known to happen historically now in the current Western societies, again, of which feminists themselves complain about and have issues. And that is really, I suppose, the end of my presentation. And I think what I wanted to kind of highlight and underline here is that the Islamic perspective comes from a point whereby both genders are complementary to each other, not in opposition, subjugation, or competition with one another. Thank you.
I'd like to sincerely thank Mr. Andalusi for his fine speech, and now call on Rebecca McKinney-Perry to open and indeed give the case for the opposition. Hear, hear.
I'm having some technical issues, so just deal with me. Bear with me for like 2 seconds.
Okay.
My speech just disappeared in 2 seconds. Okay, I'm going to start by saying that I'm here at the request of the Law Society, and I'm slightly playing devil's advocate because I don't 100% believe that all of Islam in general treats women badly. And I'm also not going to stand here and claim to be an expert on Islam, because I'm obviously not. I'm a Christian, so I guess I'm coming at this from my limited knowledge of Islam, the research that I've done today, and in general. We've had some other debates with ISOC as well. And I suppose I'm coming at it from a way in which Islam is perceived by people in the West. I'm not going to stand here and say that Islam is sexist to women. There are issues I have with Islam that I'm going to bring up in hopefully a respectful way that will not be offensive to anyone. And if I do offend anyone, I'm apologising in advance, and I have only my own ignorance to blame for that. So here we have my speech time. Okay, just give me 2 seconds. Okay, so the points I'm going to be bringing you are basically the reason I think that Islam is treats women badly or wrong is because I think that most religions actually treat women badly or wrong. So I'm going to come at this from a kind of Christianity, because I'm a Catholic, so I'm coming at this from the way that Islam and Christianity potentially subjugate women, or subjugate women in my opinion. And then I'm going to work in some rebuttal and also some of the perception of Islam versus the reality of Islam, or Islam in theory versus Islam in practice. I would actually agree with a learned colleague here in saying that Islam in theory was actually the religion before Christianity, or before the West actually gave rights to women that women previously didn't have. Because if you look at Roman times, women were seen as objects. They were seen as no better than slaves or children. So I do think that while Islam in its formation did give rights to women and did afford more rights to women than they previously had, I think that Islam has somewhat become, they haven't really progressed as much as the West has. So I'm going to lead on with, okay, so most religions treat women badly or wrong. So many religions, both in their extreme and their moderate forms, treat women as second-class citizens. At worst, women are forced to live voiceless and are subject to violence and oppression. An example of this being mercy killings, as well as domestic and sexual violence, which happens all over the world. I'm not attributing this to any one religion. At best, the way we're second-class citizens is blatant sexism. We're excluded from positions of power within religions, and also equal status, and that's within many different religions and denominations. These could be taken, we can throw passages back from the Quran and the Bible, and because they're open to interpretation, they can be interpreted different ways, but sorry, here are just some passages I found that actually are quite similar from both the Bible and the Quran, that kind of show how, in their texts, women are seen as second-class citizens, and are subjugated by their male counterparts. So from Ephesians in the Bible, "Wives, submit yourself unto your husbands as unto the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, And similarly in the Quran, to the male, the equivalent of to female, which is of course in the area of inheritance. And also from the Quran, the notion of female sexuality is also held to be a negative and punishable thing, in my opinion, for what I've read. So the quote is, apologies, "As for those of your women who are guilty of lewdness, call to witness four of you against them, and if they testify, and if they admit to what they've done, then confine them to their houses until death take them." Both these passages from the Quran and the Bible would show that women are weaker, perceived to be weaker. Obviously, I'm a feminist, I don't think that. But they're perceived to be weaker, and they're perceived to be lesser than men. I mean, even if you look at Christianity, the way that it has treated women, even in our own country, the Magdalene laundries, it's just atrocious. And I think that this is something that is actually, unfortunately, endemic in all of the religions. And so, I guess my basis for this is, because I think all, and like, I'm practicing Catholic, but I don't agree with the way that the Christian church treats women. And I also think that particularly certain parts of Islam, mostly Wahhabi Islam, treats women differently than how the Quran says they should be laid out. Today when I was researching this, I actually came across, I read loads of really fantastic articles and blogs about like feminism and Islam, which was actually really fascinating because I knew very little about it before. So I was just, the reason why online I think that women are not treated as well as Islam why they can is because there is no single authoritative understanding of the Quran or any of the other religious texts from Islam. This is always open to interpretive process, which means that people who are more fundamental and more, I suppose, conservative in their views towards women, they can always find a passage to support their views. And it's the exact same with Christian fundamentalists and Christian conservatives. So, and the reason I was, there's a project called Sisters in Islam. It's actually a Malaysian organisation. It's really fantastic. I think the work they do is really great, and possibly, hopefully, some people here have heard of it. But I was reading a lot about what they do, and even that the way that they try and get rights for women is that they have to go out and find somebody to give them a really, really progressive like interpretation of the Quran so that they can say to women, okay, look, you don't have to accept beatings, which is actually the woman who set it up. I'm probably going to mispronounce her name. Zania Anwar, I think possibly. Yeah, that's my pronunciation. She actually said that a lot of the women that she went and talked to in rural Malaysia actually believed, because of what they had heard, that oppression was justified by their Islamic teachings. And they were said, oh, you know, if you read passages of the Quran, it says that it's okay for a man to beat his wife. Which is saying, basically, I think that the patriarchy in Islam is not necessarily directed by the Quran. It's actually by traditionally male scholars of Islam. And it's their interpretation of it. They interpret it to subjugate women. And while I think that in theory Islam has the possibility not to subjugate women, unfortunately I think that in practice it's not, hasn't really moved on as much as the West has. So like I said earlier, like in the Quran, for example, an entire chapter is dedicated to women, which I think is actually, it's more, much more than the Bible contains on women. So I think that while it is there in theory, I think that in practice, it's just not upheld. And I think that actually, excuse my language, it's a bastardization of Islam which has led to women being subjugated. But unfortunately, projects like Sisters in Islam do not get enough support from the wide stream Muslim community to actually garner support in other countries. Like, I know people hate using Saudi as an example because it is Wahhabi Islam and it's not real Islam. Like, the fact that women can't drive there, the fact that they're just, like, very, very blatantly within the law, not held as equal citizens. I think that while that might be a misinterpretation or a bastardization of Islam, mainstream Islam communities and like the more moderate Muslims do not come out enough and say, look at this fantastic project in Malaysia, why don't we bring this in here? And the only reason it works in Malaysia is because Malaysia is not a theocratic state like Saudi. It's actually a pluralist democracy. While Islam is the state religion, it's not, or is the religion of the state, sorry, it's not, if you can have other religions in Malaysia.
The point of information,
In
Iran and in Sudan and Egypt and every other Muslim country, women can drive. And Saudi doesn't say women can't drive because they're deficient. It says that there are security concerns due to the instability of the Saudi kingdom. So it's not nothing to do with women's inferiority. And other Islamic regimes or quote-unquote theocracies don't prevent women from driving at all whatsoever.
Yeah, I agree with you there. And I think Saudi in general is a weak, for me, it's a weak argument to take because it's not directly, I suppose, representative of all of Islam, which I have already conceded in my point. One of the things I think about Islam, and it was in your speech, is that Well, I fundamentally disagree with that, the fact that rights are an obligation that someone has to you, and that there's no natural rights. As a law student, I read a lot about natural law, and the fact that we're given rights because we're a human being, not because somebody owes something to us. So that's just a little bit of rebuttal that I'm sure we can discuss afterwards. But in relation to a woman's role in Islam, and how you were saying that, you know, we're remembered for the family, remembered for and by the family that we have, not by what we do. I love children, but I'm not particularly sure that motherhood is for me. And I like to think that my place is not dictated by the children that I have or the person that I marry. I like to think that I actually, as bleak as it might be that we all die, I would like to go out and change things. And I think that Islam, because it is so centred on the family, and again, it's quite similar to Christianity, that it definitely says that like a woman's place is as mother, and like you said, like a mother is held three times above a father. I actually don't think that's fair either, from a gender equality perspective. I think that it imposes unfair societal gender roles on people, which actually are harmful to both people. Because if you have a man who would actually love to stay at home with his children and raise them, that's not really accepted in society in general. And I actually think that sort of more conservative Islam is actually nothing more than a conservative view a conservative representation of societal views. I mean, I agree with some of your points on the West completely, but in terms of the beauty industry and, sorry, one of your other points, the whole sexual harassment thing, I actually think it's quite demeaning to say that someone wearing a short skirt is as sexually harassing as being groped in a nightclub, and having been on the receiving end of the latter, I find that slightly
I didn't say grope though. I didn't talk about grope.
No, but sexual harassment
I said man exposing himself is equal to woman exposing herself.
No, sexual harassment implies unwanted behaviour. Just because I wear a short skirt
not to do
does not
groping,
mean
though.
That I'm sexually harassing you, in my opinion.
So groping is assault, like, not sexual harassment.
In terms of like feminism and Islam, and from what I was reading earlier, it was actually really interesting. In 1979, there was obviously the Iranian Revolution, in which Muslim countries began to gain more independence. And so this also coincided with the UN releasing CEDAW, which is the Convention on the Elimination of All Discrimination Against Women. And the reason I suppose that I think that Islam hasn't developed women's rights as fully as the West has, I'm not saying the West is perfect, because it's not, is because a lot of, I suppose a lot of, this is from what I've read, a lot of women saw feminism as being in direct contention with their religion. And actually, I was reading online, and a lot of Muslim women actually left their faith or abandoned their faith because they thought it wasn't compatible with their feminism. For me, that's a problem. There are certain parts from my own experience of the Catholic Church's teaching that I don't agree with and are in direct, I suppose, antagonistically, they're directly antagonistic to my feminism. But I wouldn't leave my religion over it. And the reason that I think as well about the beauty industry, I think to presume that anyone who goes out, and I might be reading into a speech too much, but this is actually relating to another debate that we've had here. Like, I quite like wearing makeup, and I wear it for myself, I don't wear it for men. And I quite like the idea of looking nice, and I do it for me, because it actually helps with my self-confidence. And it's not because I'm not confident, but if you're having a really bad skin day, it's really nice to put makeup on. And that's not because I feel like the media has led me to believe that that's what beauty is. It's more, that's what I do for me, and I don't do it for anyone else. And I think to presume that that's something that we force on women is actually to say to women, oh, you don't know your own mind, which I think every woman in this room most likely does, especially if they hit UCD. I suppose in conclusion, I don't think that Islam is terrible to women. I don't. Obviously, there are certain fractions of Islam which treat women badly. Wahhabi Islam and Saudi in general, they're just terrible places. But you can say the same about Christianity. You can say the same in like certain states in America where... you can say the same about Christianity, that some of the more conservative right-wingers in America, for example, like think that a woman's place is in the home and that she just shouldn't be equal to a man. So I guess I'm coming at this from become very educated today. I'm very open to questions and POIs, and hopefully I'll have some more rebuttal for you, but that's it. Thanks, Maria.
I'd like to thank Rebecca for her remarks, and now call on Mr. Andalusi again to give his rebuttal. You're here.
Well, that was fun. Right, well, let's get straight into it. Time is short. Natural law. Oh, it exists. Well, Jeremy Bentham says natural law is nonsense on stilts. That's why they developed utilitarianism, to try to find another basis for morality. You go into a desert island with natural predators, lions, tigers, and bears, oh my, and you expect them to respect your natural rights. They won't. It doesn't exist. It only exists in the human mind, and it exists in the human mind, and how does it manifest itself? By people actually having a duty to respect your rights. So all rights are based on duties, not the universe handing it to you on a silver platter. She said that women are constricted by roles to say they must only be mothers. I never said that. I said that when it comes to gender, both genders, in capacity of being of a gender, is related to their reproductive role. It is related to the family. I didn't say in their capacity of being humans. As I said, the Prophet's wife, Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, was a businesswoman. Women in Islam, historically, they were soldiers, Islamic scholars, and even street judges. Not like Judge Dredd, but they were street judges. We had the concept of a street judge. So we have. So basically, what Islam does, all it really does, is it says that the starting point is to look at the natural roles for men and women in relation to their gender, not relation to their being human, and then the exceptions resolve themselves. So if a woman gets married to a husband and she's the more dominant one, then she'll de facto be the head of the household. If she wants to go out working and her husband doesn't like it, well, then they might get divorced, or they argue, as has happened in Western relationships. But if the man is recessive, he'll accept it and he may be stay at home. Islam doesn't get involved. As to how people want to deal with that, the exceptions resolve themselves. The starting point is, do not push expectations that the woman has to be the best mother, the best housewife, and the best queer woman, that she has to have it all and ends up having to do it all at the same time. That's all Islam says. In terms of, what about how many women are subject to domestic abuse and killings? Well, if you look at what's happening in the world, more men die due to violence, wars, and even cancer rates than women do in a variety of things. Then what about feminists don't discuss the suicide rate gap, that men commit more likely to commit suicide,
more women actually attempt suicide than men, but because of the ways in which women attempt suicide, they're generally
you're saying that women are inferior to commit suicide. I'll continue. Men are more likely to die on the job. They have a less life expectancy. They're more going to be more likely to be subject to violent crime, and cancer research is disproportionately less applied to men than to women. What about there are in England only 60 male domestic abuse refuges compared to 7,500 female domestic abuse, even though there are actually much larger figures for males under domestic abuse, but no one cares about that. Men are expected to fend for themselves. There are a lot of inequalities now caused by feminist movement, which really, in my opinion anyway, respectfully, is really gender sectarianism. Any movement which only wants to argue for one side and not for all sides to have this equality is going to be for privilege, it is going to be for sectarianism. And this is why Islam prefers a holistic approach as dealing with humans, not just one or the other. Why don't you just be a universalist or so on, rather than just being feminists? In terms of in terms of other points she said that the Quran is open to... First of all, I think I would like to thank her for agreeing with the proposition of this house that Islam does treat women right, and that in its formation to its text, it says that. But she talked about now Muslims. Well, you know what? If I want to judge people based on how some people of a certain identity group act, then that's going to be a world where we're going to collectively punish all each other for everything. This is very bad. We should judge each other based on what the belief says. It's the title today is not do Muslims treat women right, or do Christians treat women right, or do atheists treat women right, or does the West treat women right, or whatever. It's does Islam as an idea, as a spiritual teaching, treat women right. There is no difference of interpretations on these things. You'll find in the Muslim world there is a struggle to actually have an Islamic renaissance, and against secular regimes in the Muslim world, and against a secular way of thinking in Egypt before Lord Cromer, as the feminists know about this, Lord Cromer, the British colonialist, and in being Irish, you know all about British colonialism, unfortunately, how they improve things. The Lord Cromer went to Egypt and he sacked women from being female doctors, and women could no longer retain their property after marriage. Women lost rights when Britain came, because he equalized it to British law at the time. So we actually were affected by this. The Muslim world is now operating off a kind of Victorian era understanding of male and female roles, and that's thanks to colonialism, nothing to do with Islam. She's mentioned about the Bible. Well, today's motion is the Islam. Maybe next week's motion can be, does Christianity treat women right? And you can defend that or not. As for the issue of inheritance, or how is it that men only get half the inheritance of females? I think it should be obvious to you now, men are expected to be the breadwinners. The woman doesn't have to spend a single penny on herself or her children in the marriage. The man is obligated in Islam and expected to provide for the family. So obviously he has to be given somewhat more inheritance to achieve that. As for the issue of four witnesses, judgment against a woman guilty of lewdness or guilty of adultery, she's to be confined to her home. Yes, because if a male was guilty of lewdness, which needs four witnesses, it would be capital punishment. So I think women actually gets off better than the man. Now, this is not about Sharia today. It's not about the Sharia law and capital punishment. Whatever your issues about that, it's about how women are treated. And even in that situation, women are treated better than men. As for the issue of wife beating and so on, or some rougher reference to the Quran about wife beating, in the Quran it doesn't say that you should go and beat your wife. What it says in the Quran, and what it says also in the Hadith, first the Hadith, the Prophet Muhammad said, do not beat your wives. And when some people who were dealing with wives who were breaking the law, unlike for women bringing their husbands to court, and the court can subject her husband to corporal punishment for rebelling and for not fulfilling his role as a husband, in Islam we didn't want to see women dragged into Islamic courts and corporally punished in public. So it was at the discretion of the husband, subject to limits, subject to restrictions, and if he went over those restrictions, he can be punished by the law court system. So in essence, Islam doesn't get involved in terms of what people do in their own homes, but if he steps over the limits and abuses his wife, then he will go to court and he can be corporally punished. Again, that's something else. So women, again, have it better. They're not dragged into public and subject to public humiliation by public punishment. As to the issue of, she said that just because a woman wearing a short skirt is not equivalent to groping, as I mentioned before from the bench, I didn't talk about groping. Groping is assault. It's not harassment. You're not harassed when someone gropes you. You are assaulted. Sexual, I believe in equality on this. If a woman wears revealing clothing, this is equal to a man wearing something revealing or acting in a revealing manner. Equal equality between the genders. If one does something wrong, the other one does something wrong, and you should hold them both to the same measure. Unfortunately, feminism castigates the male and allows the female a privilege, which ends up being gender sectarianism. It ends up being privilege. As for the issue of apostasy, that some women are apostatizing because they can't reconcile feminism with Islam, well, they chose feminism. It can't be reconciled. Islam believes in more universal treatment towards humans. It doesn't believe in some special gender sectarianism or gender privilege as feminism believes in. It's not individualistic, and of course there would be a natural clash between the two. If they want to pick feminism, then they pick feminism. If they want to pick Islam, they pick Islam. Why should we try to change Islam to fit some people's conveniences? We call this hypocrisy, right? Or insincerity. If you want to be sincere, you embrace something for what it is. It's like me, if I go and get into a relationship with someone and say, you know what, I'll leave you unless you change yourself. What would you say? What would you say? You haven't accepted that person for who they are. So you have to accept Islam for what it is and not say we must change it. And lastly, and I think this highlights the point I'm saying, the honourable lady here mentioned that she wears makeup for herself. And this is a very common argument we hear from feminists, that, oh, when I look beautiful and go out to make sure that my dress is right and so on, so when I do it for myself. Well, see, the thing is that if they were stuck on a desert island with no hope of ever seeing society again, they wouldn't wear makeup to make themselves feel better. They would, well, as I said, the issue is that if it's about yourself, why are you concerned about your physical looks, right? Who sees your physical looks, right? If there was no mirrors,
How would your physical looks affect you? It's to do with what you look like to other people, ultimately, or in some point or way or form. It's so ingrained into women that your physical looks affect your confidence that we have this kind of statement, which only reinforces the Islamic point that women should not be judged by their looks and women should not be forced to wear something to make themselves feel better about themselves. Women are fine just the way they are.
Okay, so much to tackle. Where to start? Okay, I think it's patronising that you're telling me that I do it for something else, even though I'm fully confident that I do it for myself. And if I could take a makeup bag to Desert Island, wouldn't be my first priority, but I'd probably take it. I think that you have a very narrow view of feminism. There's a buzzword going around feminism for the last while is intersectionality, and it's to do with the fact that it's not just gender that oppresses somebody, it can be other factors such as your class, where you're from. I don't think that feminism is just about women, and I wouldn't be involved in feminism if I just thought it was about women. I do agree with some of your comments about, for example, male suicide rates are higher. Attempts are higher in women, but successful male suicide is higher than successful female suicide, and that is something that does need to be tackled. I also think it's very... boiled my blood slightly that you were complaining about the fact that there were less domestic violence met people that were men than women, when statistically, if you look at it, women are more victims. 96% of perpetrators of sexual and domestic violence are men by themselves. Only 2% of perpetrators of sexual and domestic violence, this is in Ireland, are women. The other 2%, if my maths is correct, is when it's more than one party acting. So I actually think that's got really nothing to do with the debate. So I'm just going to, I'll take you in a second. I'm actually just going to move on from that. Feminism is not about sectarianism. As someone who is from Northern Ireland, and yes, I am going to bring this into play, I know exactly what sectarianism is about. And to compare feminism to sectarianism, it's not only offensive to every single feminist in the room, it's personally, I find it just, it's really offensive in general. Feminism is not about putting men down and women being better, it's about equality for all in every sphere of life. Now, the other things I had, we're saying that I did agree with you slightly, and I did concede that in theory, I don't think Islam is about the subjugation of women. But I think that any movement is defined by the people in it. It's not just about theory, it's about practice. And also, with regards to religion changing, I think religion should always adapt to the times that they change in and the people that are in them. It's not like this was a Westerner saying Islam should change. These were actually Muslim women saying, I'm not sure what to do with my political beliefs and my religion. And I think there's an inherent problem if you're forced to choose between your religion and your politics, as I see them as entirely separate things. I'm religious and I'm political, and I would never let one influence the other. I also think that when you said women are forced to have it all, there's nothing wrong with wanting to have it all. I want it all. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I would like to have a career in which I make the world a better place and also feel fulfilled as a person. And I think that actually everyone having it all is an ideal that I aim for, and I don't think that's a negative thing. I also, in terms of religions... changing, and you said that, you know, why should we change Islam? I mean, people said the same thing about Catholicism. That's why we had Vatican II, and that's why we're looking at things within the church, because no religion is perfect, in my opinion. I just think that I've gotten slightly more defensive this time around than I was in my first speech. Also, going back to the sexual harassment thing, I think, honestly, if you're presuming that someone's, like, someone wearing a short skirt, that is not akin to sexual harassment. It's not akin to sexual harassment in the law, and it's not akin to sexual harassment in reality. It's just not. And I think that actually diminishes victims of sexual harassment. And I think that to presume that our base nature is to sexually harass, and that by wearing a short skirt, that when I'm wearing a short skirt, it's, oh, we should worry about the man who's going to be sexually harassed, or if a woman's wearing, or if a man's wearing shorts, sure about, oh, the woman who's going to feel sexually harassed. I just don't buy that point, and I don't feel like you've proved how that became to sexual harassment, in my opinion. In terms of feminism and Islam, the only reason it's worked in Malaysia is because Malaysia has a robust middle class in which women are actually pretty active in the workforce, and that's in a recent poll by Gallup. They do worldwide surveys in over 137 countries. It actually shows that rates of female participation in the labour force in Arab countries are some of the lowest in the world. And like, that's a problem for me, because in Western societies, and I'm not saying that's anything to do with religion, women do take a more active role in the workforce. And I think that by saying, and I don't think gender roles are good for either male or female, or those who don't fall in between. And also, I think that's something that Islam and most religions, to be honest, ignore. The fact that there are certain people who don't fit binary measures, like, I don't really fit the, like, good, meek little girl that I guess some people might want me to be. And I'm not saying that's Islam, I'm saying that's probably society in general. Women are seen as being...
There are some exceptions resolved themselves.
Sorry?
Exceptions resolved themselves.
No, see, I don't buy that. I think that's a cheap retort to my argument. I think that saying exceptions resolve themselves, like... They don't. Like, that's, you can't say for every exception, oh, sure, they'll be fine, let's put them in a corner, they're an exception. I just don't buy that argument. I had some more rebuttals, let me just find it. Oh, yeah, in terms of, like, men as breadwinner, like, I think that's an unfair obligation on men as to women. I think to say to a man, you always have to be strong, and to a woman, you always have to be weak, is actually unfair on both, which is just then again proving that feminism is not just about the men, and I am a gender equality officer, I'm not just a feminist officer. And it does, I say in the Quran also, correct me if I'm wrong, I was actually passed this on by a friend of mine, the testimony of one man is worth that of two women. Am I incorrect in saying that the Quran says that?
Not for general cases.
Okay, also in terms of Sharia, which I know we've kind of stayed away from, Sharia law cases, particularly in family law, women have actually been treated really badly and marginalised by Sharia law cases, and which is why in Malaysia at the minute they're actually looking to kind of rejig the laws in favour of being more balanced and being more equal towards women. Let me see... Oh yeah, so in terms of, like, I don't think that Islam in its very nature is patriarchal or sexist. I think that it's actually an interpretation of Islam, which unfortunately has been propagated by male scholars, because, let's be honest, everyone generally, back when these religions were founded, were men. The scholars were men, because women were not educated, and that goes for every religion, obviously not just Islam. So I think that there is a patriarchy underrunning...
Yeah. Do you find that sexist remark? So you're saying that men can't be objective about their religion?
No, what point of mine?
I mean, they can't be objective and give a correct understanding of religion or what they really.
No, but you're obviously only getting, considering women make up 52% of the world's population, to take only the opinion of 48% is not very equal. And considering we're all about equality today.
There were women scholars in Islam and asked women scholars.
No, but to the same amount of men, or to equal to proportionate to the population, I don't think so.
Well, it's women's choices.
So, okay, that's a whole other argument. We can discuss this.
In the job market, even in the West, in the job market, women then tend to choose family over just solely career-minded work.
Well, I think that's slightly skewing off topic, and that's a debate you and I can. I would actually be delighted to have that debate with you afterwards. In terms of Islam now, I don't think Islam is a terrible religion. I've said this before. There are actually things about Islam I really like. I think the five pillars are fantastic. The charity nature of Islam is fantastic. Do I think that it still has places to go in terms of women liberation? Definitely. Do I think that Christianity and other world religions have places to go in terms of women's liberation? Definitely. Do I support the Hayes motion that Islam does not treat women well? I do and I don't, and I've outlined why I do and why I don't. I think that in general society has a long way to go in how it treats women and to make sure that women are equal in every sphere of the sense. And unfortunately, Islam is just a contributor towards this, towards the progress of us getting there. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Rebecca and indeed both speakers for what was quite a thought-provoking and interesting debate. I'd now like to open the debate up to the floor, and then following that we'll have closing remarks from the speaker and we'll put the motion to the House. But for the moment, if anyone has a remark to make to either speakers, now is perfect time to do so. Yes, go ahead.
To the lady, you were,
sorry, could you speak up just a small bit?
Sorry, I just can't hear you. You were talking about how, like, Islam it's a nice concept and practice, but practically it doesn't work. I found a lot of your arguments were also very, like, you know, they were nice ideas, they were nice, concepts, but practically I don't see them working at all. I mean, like, looking at college life, political life, celebrity life, I think there is like a lot of stuff that goes on.
Oh no, I totally agree. I think that, like, it's not perfect. It's not perfect in any, like I kind of said there with closing remarks, the world is not a perfect place for either gender. And unfortunately the religions contribute to that, because they are so slow to change, and they are so slow to, I don't know, push for, because once you have a tradition, like, to deviate from that is huge. It's a big deal to religions because they're so based in a different time and a different place. What specifically,
for example, like, just the big example that strikes me. In Ireland, mixed schools and same-sex schools. Why do girls-only schools, girls in them, dress up less than mixed schools?
Probably, like, societal pressure. Oh no, I'm not saying societal pressure is not there.
We're
like,
good about myself, apparently.
Well, some of us are just beautiful as others, though. No, like, I do in any way try and diminish the fact that the media has a terrible, like, the beauty industry in general is not a great place. It's not a great place for women. Oh no, not at all. That might have come across wrong, but I actually spoke in a debate here like about a month ago, which I said that the media actually has a really bad role in society. Like, I completely agree with you. Like, I don't think that the media is perfect. So I think the beauty industry and the standards we hold women to in beauty are unrealistic. So I'd agree with you there. But I suppose in debates we always do try and be idealistic. So when I give a speech, I like to talk about the world as I'd like it to be, and try and juxtapose that with how the world is. That's what I was trying to do with this debate, kind of juxtapose Islam in reality versus Islam in theory, because I don't think they're the same.
Okay, yes, go ahead.
I have a question that I'd like to go to the gentleman, but I don't want to address these things, and I have my own personal interest. First of all, when you differentiate between Islam, the religion, and Muslims, I was wondering, do you think that there is anybody out there who practices Islam? Do you think there's such thing as a Muslim who does practice Islam the way it ought to be practiced? And secondly, when you talk about makeup and fashion in Western society, I think there's plenty of evidence here that that's not just something in Western society. There are plenty of people here wearing makeup who are Muslims. And even when you look at head coverings or the style of Muslim clothing, it does have a fashionable element to it. And including the different forms of head covering from different communities, the colours. I mean, it's not something.
No, we want to jump in Paris now.
I also was wondering. I understand from reading about the history of Islam why people wear coverings and why people cover their body and wear loose clothing. But I was wondering, do you not think, and it'd be interesting maybe if you address this, do you not think that itself, the idea that a woman should cover her body, actually fetishizes the female body and actually draws more attention to to female sexuality, to the female body than would otherwise be the case? And in Western society in particular, if the reason why a Muslim woman would cover herself is for modesty or not to draw attention to herself, unwanted attention, in Western society that would actually have the opposite effect. I'd be interested if somebody here...
Stop you there and let him answer your first remarks, because this is another debate that we need to have.
Can I just really quickly, because it is, I think...
Okay, this will be like 30 seconds, quick, go.
In Western society, it is a female Muslim more likely to be stared at if she's covered or if she's not covered? And also when you talk about independent women, this is the dead last one. When you talk about that women, when you talk about that women shouldn't be told they have to have everything, why then so often is Khadija held up because she had everything? Because she was a wealthy, independent woman. If that's not something you're supposed to aim for.
Okay.
Alright, then in reverse order, that shopping list of questions. Sorry. Alright, Khadija isn't praised because she was a merchant. She's praised because she was virtuous. She's praised because she stood by the Prophet Muhammad and helped him with both his moral fortitude and there when he needed her in his times of trial. We bring her up to counter the myth that Islam is against women working. That's the only reason. We only bring her up because, you know, people, Islamophobes bring up that women can't work. We say, well, here's an example. We don't say she must be praised because she was a rich merchant. It matters not whether she was only a mother or she was a merchant. It makes no difference. Her virtue, in Islam, we judge humans by virtue. We don't judge them by their job title. In terms of the issue of the women's covering being fetishized,
Speak for yourself, I'm joking. unfortunately, I think maybe that stems from a Western kind of almost orientalist look at the exotic foreign woman and whoa, what hidden mysteries must she have underneath her veil. I don't want to go there, but I can assure you that basically in Islamic society for hundreds and hundreds of years, and in traditional societies, even in Christian societies where they were more modest to Victorian era and beforehand, there wasn't that kind of fetishizing of women. It's very modern. When people look at porn magazines and porn, so I've heard, they don't see, oh, well, look at that covering on that girl, or look at the head cape on that. No, they see naked women, right? Women are fetishized in their nakedness in porn. That's how the porn industry sells. And the foreign woman is held up to be an exotic person where someone uses their imagination to imagine that what they saw in some kind of movie about oriental women must be what every foreign woman has. So I think that's very Eurocentric. As for the issue of why is it that in many other societies outside the West, people are dressing according to fashion, even makeup and so on. Well, that's globalization, that's colonization, that's a whole number of factors. Was why everyone wears a suit, the same kind of suit every country you go. I bet 100 years ago not everyone was wearing a suit and tie everywhere you went in the world. So this is globalization and colonization. But to actually answer your point about Muslims versus Islam, very simple. It's take feminism, right? It's an idea. There is no book called This is the Definitive Doctrine of Feminism, right? Even people in feminism might disagree with Emily Pankhurst, and they still argue called feminists. You can be Marxist feminists and all the kinds of feminists that there are, right? Who defines feminism? It's the feminist. Islam, it is based around the book of the Quran, which we believe is a revelation of God, and by the example of the Prophet Muhammad. This is a conceptual lighthouse that we guide ourselves by. It's fixed in a fixed position, we use it to navigate. That's why you judge Islam by what it teaches and not how Muslims act. I would say that if you looked during the Ottoman era, Ottoman Caliphate, it was an Islamic state. Western women were going to the Ottoman state and amazed at how much rights women had, better rights than in Europe. So that's kind of an example of Islam being applied. Right now, you're seeing revolutions and fighting going on as to the nature of the state. And currently, the states that oppress women, the states where women don't have much of a voice, they are secular states running on from some post-colonial Victorian hymn sheet. And we're trying to deal with that and to actually establish Islam and create Islamic states by which women can be liberated. So I hope I answered your question.
Thank you.
Okay, does anybody else have any questions or remarks from the speakers? Yes, go ahead.
Proposition. I have a very simple question. I'd like you to define. I'd like your definition of what harassment is, and what your definition of what assault is. Simply.
Sure. Well, I think the issue of harassment. Okay, I can only speak for English law, but from what I know from English law is that sexual harassment is you can sexually harass someone even if it's unintentional.
I never said sexual harassment. I mean, as harassment stands and as assault stands, I didn't put sexual in there at all.
Okay, well, assault generally means physical, and harassment basically means non-physical aspects that people do. See, that's the point, non-physical aspects. And I can't speak for Irish law, but what I can speak for UK law is what I know, is that in UK law, basically, if you create an intimidating or offensive environment, even if it's unintentional to a woman, a man can be done for sexual harassment. Right? Now, if you were to just to apply that term, and it's not outside the realm of legal interpretation, to apply that term to all the gender, that would also fulfill the criteria of sexual harassment in the UK. I don't know about Irish law, maybe it's different, but that's the issue. I think a point that links to what she said before, which is that human. She implied that I said that humans are by nature, we want to sexually harass each other. I didn't say that. She's been spinning a lot of stuff I've been saying today. Humans don't want.
That's the reverse side as well.
Sorry?
I think it's been happening on both sides. It's happened, so yeah,
right.
I respond.
All right.
The only reason I asked that, I'm not asking in terms of spinning, I'm asking because you said there was a difference.
Oh, no, not you. I'm saying that.
No, I was just asking in terms of.
Oh, no, sorry, I wasn't talking about you. I was saying that basically my opponent, I believe anyway, she spun some misrepresented some things I've been saying. Humans don't want to wake up in the morning and go, I want to sexually harass someone today. Gotta catch them all. No. People don't think like that, right? But what they do is that there, some people use as methods of flirtation or methods to try to attract attention to themselves, they use sexually aggressive overtones. And it can be ones which not necessarily are speaking to people, it could be how you act, it could be how you approach them. And as I said, both men and women do this, but men are the ones who get convicted of sexual harassment more than women do, if any. Right? And so either women are angels and men are just, you know, demons, or they're both human, but the laws, covered by feminism, treats one side unjustly, on the other side, it gives privilege.
Okay, Rebecca, there'll be 30 seconds to respond. I was just going to say, I don't think somebody showing their knees in any court of the law from my law degree would constitute harassment. That's really all I had to say, based on my studies of criminal law and other legal jurisdictions. I don't think that would hold up harassment. And again, I find the comparison incredibly insulting.
Good thing we're talking about knees then.
Okay.
Right.
Does anybody else have a remark to make to either of the speakers? Okay, I'll call on Rebecca to give a closing remark.
Well, how to sum everything up? Okay. I don't think that Islam is a religion that subjugates women solely by itself. Do I think that religions in general subjugate women? Yes. So do I think, therefore, that Islam is a religion is a religion that subjugates women? Potentially, and sometimes it does. And I think that can be said of every religion. And so I think for anyone to stand up and say that no religion, Islam included, subjugates or treats women badly in every single circumstance is a false pretense and is a false argument. In terms of like where I went with my debate, it was slightly all over the place because my opinions on this issue were slightly all over the place because I am coming of a place with not as much information, purely because I'm not Muslim. I do think though that some of the points that have been made on this side of the house are just not the reality. I mean, like, people are, like you said about feminism, things are shaped by the people who create it. And I think that to say that we take Islam as how it should be, not how it is in theory, it's just a false argument. I think it's a weak argument. I don't think it holds up to much scrutiny. Like, because there is no single authoritative understanding of the Quran and the Hadith, there is no end to the interpretive process. Therefore, you cannot say that every Muslim believes this. Therefore, you cannot say that every Muslim is strictly following Islam. Therefore, you cannot say that every single person in Islam, or that Islam in general, does not subjugate women or treat everyone badly. That supports both sides of the house. That supports my side of the house, where I'm saying that it can potentially treat women badly, and it supports your side of the house by saying that not all of Islam treats women badly. So it's kind of a win-win. In terms of like where I think that Islam in particular and why it's different from, say, other religions, would I suppose be the fact that Islam in general, from my understanding, is different to other religions. It's different in that it actually requires more of a person than other religions do. It requires you to give more of yourself, and it requires Islam influences more of your life. And I think that that is dangerous in any movement or any religion, because I think that, in my personal opinion, I don't tie my identity to Catholicism, whereas a lot of my friends who are Islamic would identify as Muslim men and Muslim women. And I think that when you hold one area of your life above all others, I think that can be potentially dangerous and can lead to the potential subjugation of women. In terms of closing remarks, I suppose, because this has gone on for quite some time, I don't really have anything else. I would love some questions or some points of information if anyone has them. Because, like I said, I'm open to correction and I'm open to people throwing things at me that maybe I don't know. So if anyone has any of those things, otherwise I'm just going to finish up by saying I believe that Islam can treat women right, but I don't believe that it always does. And I suppose that's it. Any questions or comments?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
You kept saying in your speech throughout, you kept doing it, I've only done my research for today.
Well, that's not necessarily true.
You said that for majority of your speech, and I think it'd be beneficial to do more research.
Oh, definitely.
You kept saying that Islam needs to modernize itself.
In my opinion, yeah.
Yeah. All of us here, we've all been taught since a young age to live by the Prophet.
Yeah.
And live by the Quran.
Yeah.
We don't need to modernize. People have to understand that Islam as a whole doesn't need to change.
Yeah.
People's just perception of Islam has to change.
Well, yes, I suppose that kind of links back into my point, whereas because Islam is based on interpretation, the interpretation of the Quran needs to change. That's what I'm, sorry, that I was probably unclear. That's what I meant when I said that the reason that, for example, Sisters in Islam is working in Malaysia, because it's working within the confines, is potentially the wrong word, but we'll go with confines, the confines of the Quran, because they're using more, I suppose, liberal interpretations of the Quran. So, but like, is that not then changing Islam? Because I, like, my point was that Islam is what the people make it. So if you change an interpretation of Islam, in my opinion, that would be changing Islam. Will I say I only did my research today? That's not entirely true, but I thought it would be self-serving of myself to stand up here and pretend to be an expert on something which I'm clearly not. I thought that would be disrespectful to people here and would just make me look like a bit of an idiot. I actually like to think that I, like, no more than the average Westerner. I'm not saying I do. I like to think that I do, potentially, because I have friends from very diverse backgrounds. I'm not saying that's the truth. That's what I like to think. But in terms of, like, saying that Islam should change, when you change the interpretation of something, does that not then in its nature change itself? Is my question to you, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, just regards to interpretation, we not say that interpretation depends on your perspective, because everyone really can interpret things differently, and not just to do with Islam, but to do with any religion or even political views and,
oh, definitely.
And like how the media can show things as well. So I think it's not the best argument to say that.
But in terms of the only reason that Sisters in Islam worked in Malaysia is because they had a well-educated female workforce, so they were coming from a place where they could actually say, okay, let me look at this and let me say, okay, let's see if there's a more liberal interpretation out there. It was actually the reason that they went and got a more liberal interpretation was women were taking their husbands to Sharia courts and they were trying to win the cases. Obviously, that's any point in a law case. And they had to go off and find, I actually have the name of the woman here, I'm not going to be able to pronounce it. And so she went off, the woman who set it up, and found a more liberal interpretation of something. Like, everything is obviously open to interpretation, but I feel like you can't fully interpret something if you're not coming with all the knowledge. So, if you have a well-educated middle class, if you have well-educated middle class women, they're in a much better position to interpret things because they're more educated, have seen views from other countries, have seen how the Quran operates in other countries, or Sharia operates in other countries. So I kind of, has that responded to your point? Ish. Like, I think that the only reason this worked is because they interpreted it differently. So the way that I brought this to the debate was, in order for women's rights to progress in even Sharia courts, so even within the confines of Islam, is to have a more liberal interpretation of the Quran, which is all staying within Islam. So it was actually an Islamic scholar went and she went and found a more liberal interpretation to suit Muslim women. And to further the cause of Muslim women within Sharia courts. So it wasn't even in common law courts, it was within Sharia courts. So I think that changing interpretation for the benefit of women is probably a good thing.
So, you know, I think it could be construed to completely change what is actually written down in the Quran, that Islam is.
Well, that's why you leave it to Islamic scholars and not Westerners, which it was done in this case, because then these are people who know the Quran, who have a good grounding in Islam, and if you leave it open to their interpretation, not just Westerners, because obviously I don't know as much about the Quran as somebody who's been raised with the Quran, and I never will. But if you have Muslim scholars, Islamic scholars, Islamic lawyers, they're going to be able to interpret it in different ways. I suppose that's the difficulty with the Quran, because like I said, there is no authoritative force, like this is 100% what it is, because it is open to interpretation. So, but, yeah, I think that's
okay.
It then.
Let's leave that there and invite him here and let's get this.
Right, well, we've heard some very interesting discourses and some very interesting questions today. I think we've touched on too many topics that we can fully cover today, such as feminism, and I'm sure maybe you should invite the men's rights activist groups in who are Western organisations who have a thing to say about the kind of gender sectarianism that feminism has caused. They're not Muslim, and these are non-Muslims who have making these points. Okay, I don't want to go in too much into the issue of feminism, but there are some issues which are being ignored, and this is issues that are being raised, like the Guardian newspaper, which is a UK newspaper, raised a report which shows that 40% of domestic abuse victims are actually male. A lot of it goes unreported. We see that, you know, Wall Street Journal noted that women tend to do less overtime hours. Men do more overtime hours. Women choose to do more family-oriented positions and take more time out for their families. They make that choice. No one's coercing them. No one's forcing them. This happens in Western country. Now, the point is, why is it that we see feminists demand 40% quota for board members? So all board members, 40% must be, let's say, women. Irrespective of the merit of, let's say, maybe one particular board, you know, the best candidates, maybe 80% are men at that particular time, but no, 40% must be women. That makes us choose the lesser qualified candidate. There are many cases where we will have to choose a lesser qualified candidate rather than the better qualified candidate because we're judging on gender and we're not judging on merit. What I would say, sorry.
I'm sorry. I don't think it's fair to say that all feminists are for this 40% quota as good.
Yeah, okay, not all feminists. Yeah, sure. That's an internal debate between feminists, but very prominent feminist organizations do this. But we hear no discussion as a 40% quota for women on soldiers, prison guards, lumberjacks, miners, bodyguards, or construction workers. You will hear no feminist talk about demand a 40% quota for women for that. Why is that? Why is it only the really executive jobs we see this kind of quota going on? If they really were for equality, it would be equality across the board. Now, these are the kind of evidences I bring just to show that it's not as simple or as the feminists would like to portray. Now, she did say that, okay, Islam in theory, yes, it might treat women right, but her point is religions in general. We're not talking, that the motion today is not, do religions in general treat women right? You know, please bring a Buddhist, a Christian, an atheist, and so on, and they can walk into a pub. Pop, speaking of a joke, but they also can have a debate, and they can, and you can debate them on this issue. I'm only talking about Islam. The real issue, and I don't want you to be swayed by the issue here between maybe individualism versus maybe a family-orientated, system. Yeah, Islam is family-orientated. It's not individualistic because humans aren't individuals. Right, you were born into a culture, into society. You depended on other humans to teach you your knowledge. If no human teaches you anything, according to source, and anyone who studies psychology, he will tell you, children born in the wild, they never learn language, and up to a certain age, they'll never learn it. You need other human beings to even give you the very capacity to think. Right, most of you are social products. Right, we are social creatures. You know, the worst punishment you can give someone is you put them in solitary confinement. If they're an individual, oh, I'd love it. No one telling me what to do. No, you'd hate it. Even if it was on a desert island, you'd hate it. Right? We need each other. We affect each other. We depend on each other. Islam just recognizes the humanity behind us, and not saying that we are some kind of disembodied individual. She mentioned that Islam needs to modernize. We're in a modern system. It's like we need some kind of Islam 2.0 or upgrade its operating system. Well, you modernize first. You use democracy, right? Isn't that like 2,500 years old as a system? And yet Islam needs to modernize. See, systems don't change. Technology changes. You know, but systems don't change. How you organize human relationships or systems of government doesn't change. So, Lily up there.
Sorry, I just have a point to make on that.
Sure.
Growing up in Ireland and my previous two generations, they would even say that there has been a change in Ireland. We had our we Catholic Ireland, and our constitution was written on quite Catholic grounds. I mean, it says that economically, a woman is best placed in the home, and I've seen that change. But also, we are now questioning our Catholic and fundamental beliefs with things such as divorce referendums and gay marriage next year and contraception. So yeah. We've actually taken our fundamental ideas and we've actually gone, you know what, as Rebecca made the point of earlier, not to have one main area of our life here, such as religion and one is politics, yeah. We've actually gone, hang on, we need to put these together and we need to put them both into our lives so we can work together. So we actually disagree with that we can actually look at our fundamentals and we can actually change them to modernise ourselves and to continue.
But that's humans changing their beliefs, not the beliefs, or rather human beings as in creatures changing. Systems change if people change those systems, right? If the system itself doesn't need to change if people retain that system. Technology can change, but the change of technology doesn't change the system necessarily. So Roman democracy, very similar to the kind of democracy we have in America now, even though the Roman Empire was like 100,000 years ago. See, systems are just relationships between people, how you organize relationships. Technology only changes that. If people want to change how they relate to each other due to a change in their creed or doctrine, that's people changing their belief, not the need for systems to change. So my point is that humans are still the same creatures we were 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years, 5,000 years ago. Take a baby now in a time machine, go back, put them in there, they'll grow up to be a normal Roman or whatever, and take a Roman baby here, raise them up, they'll be a normal average modern person, whatever, right? Humans don't change, technology changes fundamentally. So Islam doesn't need to change for the times. As Muslims, we just need to develop our technological based industry and innovation. That's really all that really needs to change. That was my point. Now the thing is, Islam is based on, as I say again, a book, and upon the example of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. This book regulates us, the Prophet's example guides us. The reason why Muslims know there's a problem in the Muslim world is because the Muslim world is so far from the example of the Prophet Muhammad, which we have clearly in his sunnah, in his traditions, and it's far from what God has ordained. This is why there are Muslim revival movements and Muslim campaigning movements and political movements. We're trying to create an Islamic society, which Muslim movements notice there is no Islamic state or society. Saudi Arabia is a British imposed monarchy, and then it just became an American backed monarchy. So these countries are post-colonial relics. We want to get rid of them as much as you do, right? Unfortunately, they keep being backed and supported by various governments around the world, mostly from the Northern Hemisphere, unfortunately. Right, we're trying to deal with that. With that, I wish people would let us deal with our own governments by ourselves, rather than putting new governments upon us. Now, as for the issue of Malaysia, and places like Brunei and other places, and Iran, Sudan, and many other these Islamic projects, they believe to gradually apply Islam. So we apply some things of Islam, and maybe hopefully we'll bring about an Islamic state gradually. The problem is Islam doesn't work if you just apply a little bit of it. It causes trouble. So if I just say inheritance only, inheritance double for men, and I don't assign men the responsibility to look after their families and pay for their children and families, then men it becomes a privilege. And I would agree with you, it becomes a privilege. Wrong. But if an Islamic system in place whereby men would then be expected to take responsibility for their families, financial responsibility, then it doesn't become a privilege, it becomes an equaling out. Wherever you give a privilege, you match with responsibility, it is equal. The police and your government, they have more powers than you, right? They have more privileges than you. But you don't say they're privileged because they have equal, they have more responsibility than you. So a policeman can carry a gun, you can't carry a gun, but he has more responsibility. He has to do a job with that gun. You don't have to do a job with that gun. So the policeman is allowed something extra, but has more responsibility. The policeman is still fundamentally equal to you. In Islam, same with the genders, same between the ruled and the ruling, same between the rich and the poor. You might those who have more obligation upon them to those who don't, or those who don't have that. So this is how Islam preserves equality. What I will say in conclusion is that it is Islam, as I've mentioned by many references, these texts I've quoted about how Islam views women fundamentally as equal, as Islam only judges men and women only based on their virtue, not their economic productivity, or how much they, or how well or nice or fair they look. This is a non-disputed, non-contentional aspect of Islam. There is no difference of opinion on this matter. And as Muslims, we debate about a whole number of things. Usually, we disagree about roughly, I would say, about 5% of Islam we disagree on. The rest is 95%. We generally agree. We all pray the same way. We don't have different sacraments. We all basically believe about the obligation of a man to his family, that he can't just neglect his children, neglect his wife, or insult his wife. We have this as not controversial. There is no Islamic scholar, even the most backward hillbilly scholar you can find, who says that a man can abuse his wife and could do whatever the hell he wants to his wife. You won't find that. The problem that we're trying to deal with is that there are Muslims in the Muslim world who they act on this Victorian era hymn sheet, and they are secular and they view us as backward because we want to implement Islam. They look down upon us and they think that what we're calling to is something alien to their culture, of their nation. They're very nationalistic, these people. These people are not representing Islam. We have a name for this in Islam. We call them jahil. We call them ignorant. They are ignorant of Islam, and you'll find no contentious debate amongst Muslim scholars about what I've said today. What I basically said today, all Muslim scholars agree. And I think, ladies and gentlemen, I think you've heard that the case that my even opposition admits that in theory, or according to the idea, Islam treats women right. The topic today is, does Islam treat women right? And I would like to invite you to agree with me and my opposition that this is indeed the case. Thank you.
Okay, thank you all very much. I'd like to just say a few thank yous, because this is, believe it or not, my last house debate as auditor of the society. I know, shocker. I'd like to firstly thank everyone from the Islamic Society and everyone who came out tonight, even if you come to the debates regularly or if this is one of the first debates you've come to. You're always more than welcome. We're delighted to have you. Sincere thanks to the Islamic Society. It's always a pleasure to work with you guys, and I hope that that relationship certainly continues in the future, because you've always been brilliant in the past and during this session as well. I'd like to thank our speakers for coming out. I thought that was probably one of the most thought-provoking debates that I certainly chaired during my time as Auditor of the Law Society, and it was really, really fantastic, and I'm delighted that that's going to be my last debate. But without any further ado, and without kind of putting more spotlight on myself, I'd like to put the motion to the House. So on the motion that this House believes that Islam treats women right, all of those in favour, please raise your hand and say aye. And about five of you who are opposed to the motion, please raise your hand and say nay.
Nay.
Okay, on that basis, the motion has been passed. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.